Well, good morning. It's good to be back. I was on vacation last week, and it was wonderful. This time last week, I was sitting in the sanctuary of Unity Village Chapel and getting ready for Aaron McCabe's talk, which was wonderful. It was so interesting and good. The musician we had for our silent retreat is a woman named Kelly Hunt. I think she's quickly becoming one of my new favorites. But she had been playing this wonderful, soft, supportive, loving music through our silent retreat, and then the first song that she played at the chapel, because she was the guest musician, was one of those rocking where you can't stay in your seat kind of song. Oh, who knew? It was great. We are starting a new class this week, as Marcia mentioned, on prosperity. It's called Prosperity. Bernetta just finished. Lost Vernetta. There she is. She just finished one called The Creative Process just a couple weeks ago. This actually kind of snuck up on me real fast. But anyway, here it is. We're starting it this week. As I have been preparing, as I've been looking at the materials, reading through them, there is a new book new to me. Actually, it's one of those that's on my shelf, and it's been there for a while. You guys have books that you haven't read? Okay, yeah. I've had it for a while, so it's a new book for me. It's called The Soul of Money. And as I was reading it, it's different than what one would expect a prosperity book to be. And I think as I read it, I think it is a wonderful bridge to go from what we know and teach in Unity about abundance and prosperity, the principles that we try to live, and then today's current world. It's a bridge to link those two, I think. So we're going to be looking at prosperity. One of the things I found very interesting about this book right away was she said that we, each and every one of us, have a relationship with money. I had never really thought about it in that way before, that I have a relationship with money. But I, kind of quickly, as I read, I see what she's saying. Lynn Twist is the author of The Soul of Money. I didn't know anything about her before I started reading this book, but she was one of the early participants in the Hunger Project, if you know about that, in the 80s, so I think like 1983. And she writes of these rich experiences that she had on this Hunger Project. She's an activist and for ending hunger, world hunger, and she's a fundraiser. And I don't know about you, but when I think about fundraising, it's like, ugh. it's like, kind of like to ask people for money. But that has to do with my relationship with money. So as we go through this class, I'm hoping that me and all of us will begin to look at how we think about money, how we live with money a little differently. One of the things she says is what this book is not about. It is not about turning away from money. There are a number of more traditional churches where we are led to believe that it is almost sinful to have money. And they point to scripture. It's something about the root of, money is the root of all evil. But it doesn't say that. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. So this book is not about turning away from money, avoiding it, getting rid of it. It is not about the regular things that you would think about, financials, simplifying expenditures, or creating a budget, or what else did they say? Oh, financial planning. Not about any of that sort of thing. It is different from a prosperity book than I had looked at before. What it is about, and I like this, it is about living consciously, fully, joyfully in our relationship with money. It's a different way of looking at it. It is about learning how to understand and embrace the flow of money. And then it says that And I don't disagree with her, because there's another woman named Maria Namath who wrote a book, I think it's called The Energy of Money, and very similar principle. It says that exploring your relationship with money is in itself, or can be, a spiritual path, a way to a spiritual path, a way of deepening, a way of discovering wholeness and peace of mind. Well, that's pretty cool, I think. So we're in the class. We're going to be going further into this than what we're going to be talking about. I'm intending that this week and the next couple of weeks at least are going to be sort of a surface level anyway of some of these principles that we'll be talking about in class. And I hope it kind of whets your appetite so that you might want to come and learn some more as we go deeper into some of these ideas. She talks about money. She says that in our society, often we use money to measure our worth. And I think there are many examples of how we do that. I have seen videos, you know, of what I call social experiments. You know, they'll put somebody on the street and see how many people contribute, you know, that kind of thing. So there are judgments that we make about people based on the absence or the prevalence of money. So sometimes we use money to assess and judge the importance of people and our own self-worth. I like this. This was do you like alliteration? You know, where they use the same sound all. Anyway, I like this. So I'm going to share it with you. She said, "Money is the most universally motivating, mischievous, miraculous, maligned, and misunderstood part of contemporary life." Intriguing, and it is. I think it is. But she goes on then to say that it only has the power that we give it. She had a beautiful example. She has all these rich examples, but she talked about a tribe of indigenous people, and I think it was South America, and they lived in a remote enough place that they really didn't interact with civilization or society. They had their own system of sharing, of, you know, taking care of each other, working with each other. You know, if I've got this, then I'll share it with everybody and I'll receive from everyone else. It's a beautiful system. And this group was living in an area that apparently was, according to the world, resource rich. So outside people had begun to contact this tribe in order to talk with them about getting access to some of those resources. In the example she used, she was saying that they were wise enough to know that they recognized this is a very different world that we're thinking about entering. We need to know how to do this and how to do it well. So they sent somebody out to study economics in the world and all that sort of thing, so that they maybe wouldn't get taken, you know, because it would be very easy to just convince a more naive group of people to give us your oil, give us your whatever. But she has this wonderful story about how they had their own life and how they lived in a system without money, and then how they began the negotiations with the outside civilization and how they dealt with money. She also talked beautifully about her experience in India. Early on in the project, she took a trip, and apparently her guide was, I can't remember his name, but he is considered Gandhi's fifth son. I think he was adopted by Gandhi. So this man is well known, he's well respected, he's a very important man in India, and he met her at the airport. She wrote how she was bombarded, sensory bombardment when she got off the airplane. The colors and the heat and the smells, not all were pleasant apparently. But just it was almost overwhelming, sensory overwhelming. And then also she said that when she stepped out into the public with her guide, the beggars, the people just swarmed them for begging, for handouts. And she noticed that they came to her for money, but they really didn't come to this other guy. It was like, and he didn't seem to notice them. He didn't see them, supposedly. She knew that he was a very humanitarian. He was very interested in uplifting people out of poverty. So it wasn't that he didn't care, but later she learned that he had to stay focused on his vision, you know, which was higher. And there's a whole cycle that we'll talk about in a minute. But in India, she was struck by the crushing poverty. She said it just was almost overwhelming. And she said that some of it was due to the caste system. A lot of it was. Here in this country, you know, what I told my son when he was growing up was, you can be anything you want to be. They don't do, you know, not there. The caste system is whatever you're born into, that's what you're going to be forever. So for this lifetime anyway, that their only hope of living a better life is then to be reincarnated into another life where you're a higher level, and so you can, it can be different. And what that creates then, I was shocked, is a whole way of being in poverty. And in some cases, like that social experiment I was mentioning, they know that the more pitiful they look when they're begging, the more money they're going to receive. And in some cases, they even mutilate their own children, maybe cut off a hand or something, to make them look more pitiful, and then they therefore get more money. I just was shocked. They are in their world then, in their, I'm always going to be a beggar, they are successful because they're getting more money than maybe some of the others. And it's a culture. You know, it's a cycle of poverty. That's the way they are. The people who give are giving, you know, the relationship, it's a dance. So the people who give are giving from that place of being shocked. They're giving from a place of perhaps pity, maybe some guilt. I've got so much and they have nothing. And so then the dance continues, and it continues. It keeps on going. It doesn't stop. When we give money in those kinds of situations, we are enabling, is what she said. I thought it was very interesting. She wrote of a visit with Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa had always been an idol of hers. You know, she was so, had always been very, very, very impressed with Mother Teresa. It turns out that when she got there, and she was there in India, and they were talking on the project and stuff, there was somebody who knew Mother Teresa and was able to make a visit happen. She was so excited. So finally the day arrived that she was to visit Mother Teresa. A driver in a car was sent to pick her up, and the driver took her into a very, very poor part of the city, and to an orphanage where these children were being taken care of. She was dropped off, and the driver waited for her. She went inside and was told that Mother Teresa had to leave. She was called away for some emergency, but she would be back. And so if she would wait, then they could talk when Mother Teresa returned. And so she said, sure. And they put her to work. They said, while you're here. So there were all these little babies, and she said she just wholeheartedly got into taking care of these little ones. Some of them were just abandoned. Some were orphaned. Some were abandoned because they were deformed in some way, and all these children that needed to be cared for, and she really got into it. So she lost track of time. She was enjoying herself and just really into the service and feeling great about being there and being able to contribute a little bit. And then finally somebody came and said Mother Teresa was back. So they went into a room and to begin their talk. They had been talking for a bit when all of a sudden, apparently, the door burst open, and there was a couple, an Indian couple, very rich, apparently, and they were dressed in fine fabric, clothing, jewels, makeup, however they did. So they were large, you know, people. They were very aggressive, though, in their mannerisms, in their movements. They came in and they wanted a picture of themselves with Mother Teresa. So they didn't knock. They burst in. They shoved the camera at Lynn Twist so that she would take a picture. And they, you know, kind of physically got Mother Teresa out of her chair and put her between them. Lynn Twist is feeling angry and upset that this is happening, but it's not her place, you know, so she's silent. She takes the camera. It sounded like, from her description, it sounded like Mother Teresa was bent. And I know my own grandmother was very bent by the time she died with osteoporosis. So Mother Teresa, I think, was bent. And this couple, I don't remember which one, took his finger in her and raised Mother Teresa's chin so that Mother Teresa's face would be up for the photo. Lynn Twist was furious, just could feel the rage. Mother Teresa allowed the photo to be taken, and then the people, you know, grabbed the camera again and left with not so much a thank you even, you know, just blustered outside. Mother Teresa went back to her seat and began, you know, resumed the conversation as though nothing had happened. And Lynn Twist had to just struggle to, she was so angry and so furious. But she got herself under control so that they could finish their conversation and their interview, their meeting, and she was happy with that. She wrote that on the way back to the hotel, she realized that here she was in the presence of this sacred woman, this woman who was so much love and expression, and she allowed herself to go to that place of fury and hate. You know, she, in her presence, was kind of an aha. Oh, I don't like that I did that. Later, she wrote a letter to Mother Teresa and explaining that she realized that she had done that. She felt very bad about those emotions taking over when those people came in. Mother Teresa wrote back to her and actually kind of admonished her a little bit for her reaction to those people. And she said that we are here to be compassionate to everyone. Yes, the people in poverty, we want to have compassion for them, but the people who have wealth also need our compassion too. And she talked about a cycle of wealth. Now, who has ever thought about how difficult it must be to have a lot of money? Some have, yeah. It isn't something I don't know that I would have. I have thought about how difficult it would be to be famous, but the money thing hadn't really occurred to me. But Lynn Twist describes, as Mother Teresa described, how people who have a lot can go to a place of fear, not being able to keep it, not having enough, whatever enough is, and it's maybe never enough, can go to a place of separation, because then you can start to get paranoid about maybe they want my money. A lot of reasons that mean that they are actually probably as unhappy as the poor people are, but in different ways. In different ways. So it was a whole, her trip to India was just mind-blowing for her. When we think about money, you know, like that couple, I guess, she talks about how she and her husband considered themselves very much family-oriented. So when we, in our lives, as we think about money and how our relationship with it, often we'll think that we are being consistent, I guess I'd call it, with our ideals. She and her husband, she looked back at the early days of their life together, and he was an executive and doing very well, and she was supportive, and of course they had money to hire nannies and housekeepers, and so She said they both thought, she and her husband thought, that their children were their first priority. And yet their actions indicated that they were almost neglectful, because it was the nannies, it was the staff that were taking care of them. The time they actually spent with their children was, when the children were very young, was pretty small. So it was an interesting experience to think about intentions versus time and energy output. You know, where do we spend our time? What do we put our energy into? Is that consistent with what we say is most important to us? Interesting. There is a piece I'd like to share with you. She, in a section that she calls Making a Living That Affirms Life, she talks about the domain of the soul versus the domain of money. She says, each of us experiences a lifelong tug of war between our money interests and the calling of our souls. When we're in the domain of the soul, we act with integrity. We are thoughtful and generous, allowing, courageous, and committed. We recognize the value of love and friendship. We admire a small thing well done. We experience moments of awe in the presence of nature and its unrefined beauty. We are open, vulnerable, and heartfelt. We have the capacity to be moved, and generosity is natural. We are trustworthy and trusting of others, and our self-expression flourishes. We feel at peace within ourselves and confident that we are an integral part of a larger, more universal experience, something greater than ourselves. I would offer that what she calls soul, we might call our higher self, we might call our Christ self, you know, the divinity within. But when we're in the domain of soul, those are the ways that we are being. In the domain of money, she says, there often seems to be a disconnect from the soulful person we have known ourselves to be. It's as if we are suddenly transported to a different playing field where all the rules have changed. In the grip of money, those wonderful qualities of soul seem to be less available. We become smaller. We scramble or race to get what's ours. We often grow selfish, petty, fearful, or controlling, or sometimes confused, conflicted, or guilty. We see ourselves as winners or losers, powerful or helpless, and we let those labels deeply define us in ways that are inaccurate, as if financial wealth and control indicate innate superiority, and lack of them suggests a lack of worth or basic human potential. Visions of possibility dissolve. We become wary and mistrusting, protective of our little piece, or helpless and hopeless. We sometimes feel driven to behave in ways inconsistent with our core values and unable to act differently. I don't know about you, but I was struck by those differences. I thought that they were very powerful. We will be talking about scarcity, because she talks about, and then she goes into scarcity and all sufficiency. We'll talk a little bit about scarcity today and some myths. She calls them toxic myths that we have often have come to believe. And then next week, we're going to talk about sufficiency, how we can begin to see it differently. As we talk about scarcity, she talks about wake up in the morning. What's the first thing you think about? She said often is, I didn't get enough sleep. I'm still tired. I didn't get enough rest. And then if we think about our day and what's going to be coming ahead, I don't have enough time. There's a huge scarcity. She calls it the scarcity lie, that doesn't seem like there's ever enough. We don't have enough time. We don't have enough We don't get enough exercise. We don't get enough of the right foods. We don't, what else was it? We don't have enough power, or we don't have enough work, or we don't have enough profit, or we don't have enough free time, or we don't have enough relationship time, or, you know, just pick something. It's too much what we don't have enough of. And then the danger in that is that then we begin to believe that the reason that we aren't where we want to be and that we don't have what we want to have is because there's not enough. We have bought into the lie to the point where that's the reason. And then further, we get to the place where we think that money can buy happiness. Maybe if I had more money, then I could buy this or that, and it would give me more of whatever. Money can buy happiness. We begin to look outside ourselves for the answers. As Unity students, we know, we have been taught forever that if, as long as we talk about prosperity, is that it isn't out there. You know, it is in here. It begins within here. A recognition that God is substance, and there is plenty. There is more than enough. And it is when we are in alignment that then we can begin to manifest, express some of that. This, I think, is a way of kind of bridging that, as I said earlier. Scarcity, lie. She said, along with that, then, there are these three toxic myths. The first one is, there is not enough. The second is, more is better. And the third is, that's just the way it is. I don't know about you, but even when I read the words, it resonated. I thought, oh, yeah, I can see how. Yeah, I can see how I believe that. So next week, we're going to go more deeply into those toxic myths, and then we're going to talk about sufficiency. We know the truth. We know the truth about there being plenty. There is always plenty. But as we are, with anything, as we are able to shed these erroneous beliefs, these ideas about where our good comes from, as we can shed those, then we open ourselves and can more completely express and be who we have come here to be. Let's go ahead and take a few moments now to what I call practice the presence. Take a few moments to experience our connection with the divine. We take a few moments out of our busyness, our schedules, to be still, to experience stillness in our bodies, to experience stillness in our minds, and then to experience the connection that comes from being in stillness. And so, as we do each week, I invite you, if you haven't already, to gently close your outer eyes and allow your bodies to just relax. You might want to mentally scan from the top of your head, mentally moving down your body, noting where there are places of tightness, tension, and consciously releasing, bringing relaxation to that place. And we breathe. As we breathe and allow that breath to slow and become deep, we find our bodies responding by even more relaxation. And as we put our awareness simply on the breath, breathing in and breathing out, we might well feel our thoughts slowing. And the more we focus on the breath, simply the sensations, the movement of the air, the breath, the more quiet, the more open, and the more receptive we become. We absolutely know that as we spend time in the quiet, it's like a bank deposit. The more time we spend, the more we are aligned with that true self, the better able we are to go back to that place when waters get stormy. Breathe. We may well begin to feel a sense of peace, a sense of safety, a sense of well-being. In this moment, there is nothing to do, nowhere to be. We can relax. We can be silent. We can be free. It is in these moments of silence and connection and peace that we then often also feel an expansion of what I call our real selves, our true selves, an expansion of love and joy, our true nature. It happens when we allow ourselves to be silent, to put aside our busy outer lives, and to give time and attention to what really matters, to that relationship with the divine, to the recognition and the embodying of what is called our divine identity. And so we practice. We practice the presence. Here and now, as we do each week, we set aside time in silence to just be still and be in the silence. We are renewed. We are refreshed. We are re-energized. We come out of these times with a better understanding, a better appreciation for the true meaning of peace. When Jesus said, "My peace I give to you." We come out of these times feeling, knowing that we are an extension of that divinity here in this world. And we are grateful. The more we do this, the more we commit to being the peace in the world, to being the love in the world, to being the light in the world. We commit to being the Christ in expression as best as we can be. And as we do each week, we complete our time of silence, complete our time of contemplation by coming together to affirm and pray Jesus' words, the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever.